Game over!
Game over!
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
So serious.
I am Iron Man.
This is a tasty burger.
Welcome to the In Session Film Podcast.
Welcome to this week's extra film segment for May 10th, 2018. And I'm J.D. Duran.
And I'm Brendan Cassidy.
Thanks for joining us this week, everybody. If you're not familiar with our extra film segment, this is something we do every Friday where we get together and we talk the small films out there, the indies or classics that we normally don't have time for on our main show. And Brendan, I bought a bag of 6 balloons for this week's show.
Wow, it sounds like you wasted a lot of money for that.
That is arguably very true. I don't really have any use for them. They're just sitting around the table here.
Yeah.
But we are going to be getting into 2 films that will make sense of that comment. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about the French film, A Bag of Marbles, based off of an autobiography written in the 70s. And is getting some pretty good reviews. So I look forward to diving into that with you here shortly. And similar to last week in the back half of the show, I'm going to step away for a few moments. We are going to be joined by the Vern from Vern's Video Vortex and Cinema Recall as he and Mr. Cassidy over there, they are going to be talking about a little indie out on Netflix right now. It is called 6 Balloons.
Yeah.
A film that I've actually seen, I've discussed on another show, but I didn't really have a lot of time to prep for this week's show. So.
It's called Parental and Fatherly Duties, man.
Yeah, I've had a very busy week, a lot of things going on in my personal life, so I figured I would let someone else come in and handle the duties for that film. So, but I do look forward to hearing what you guys have to say on that movie.
Yeah.
I also want to take a quick second here to plug this week's poll. Now, if you listened to episode 272, you may have heard us plug another Netflix film that we were potentially thinking about for the main show this
weekend. Keywords, potentially.
Yeah, we weren't exactly sure what we were wanting to do, but at the time, the John Woo film Manhunt, which is out on Netflix, we were thinking about maybe doing that film, but coming into this week, I'll just say, Brendan, I was on the fence. I wasn't exactly sure if that's what I truly wanted to talk about this weekend, and then came the news that Vertigo celebrated its 60th birthday this week from its release in cinemas, and that sounded quite appetizing. So for our poll this week, inspired by that film, which we will be giving a full review of on episode 273. So for our poll, we asked, what is your favorite Hitchcock film? And that has led to some really interesting discussion on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
And I look forward to diving into all of that this weekend on the show. But yeah, I love the conversation so far on that, Brendan.
Yeah, absolutely. It also goes to show just how many Hitchcock films I have to give a rewatch to, because a lot of his great films I haven't seen in a long time. I think the last time that I saw The Birds, for instance, I was probably still in diapers. It really was a while since I've seen some of these films. I remember really liking a lot of them, but I cannot wait to discuss a movie like Vertigo, which is a film that I've actually seen at least 6 or 7 times. It's one I'm very fresh on.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I'll probably give it another rewatch prior to our discussion this weekend.
Simply because we want to.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the film. It's made several top 3 lists for us in the past. In fact, I went back and listened to our Nightcrawler episode where we talked about movie obsessions.
Yeah.
And that film made both of our lists. So.
It did. Yeah. So at this point now, you know, a lot of times we go into our main reviews with the mindset that, oh, what's the listener going to, like, what are they thinking? Do these two individuals like the movie or not? There's a mystery here. That mystery is not here for this one. You should know going in that we are big fans of Vertigo.
Yeah. So I look forward to talking a little bit more as to why rather than just a 2 or 3 minute little rant during our top three segment. So
yeah,
that should be a lot of fun, but be sure to go and vote on this week's poll. And I'm with you, Brendan. I think to give a true answer to that, or if we ever did like our top three Hitchcock scenes, I'd have to rewatch some of his filmography. And there are some blind spots such as Strangers on a Train, Dial M for Murder, I need to catch up with. So
that's a good one.
Yeah, so there are a few I need to get my hands on. I think to give, you know, a more robust list, I guess. I need to be more well-rounded in my Hitchcock, even though I've seen quite a lot of his filmography already.
Yeah, so maybe another movie series in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one that I had written down on the list a long time ago, like several years ago, but you know, it just keeps getting pushed further down the list with all these other things that keep popping up. But
yeah,
I would certainly love that at some point. With all of that said, though, we'll get more into Hitchcock this weekend on episode 273. Right now, we have a bag of marbles and 6 balloons to talk about as I sit here with my bag of 6 balloons. So,
all right,
without further ado, let's get into it.
And here we go.
You're listening to the In Session Film Podcast Extra Film Segment. Brendan, it is better to get hurt now than get yourself killed to avoid getting hurt.
Should I be nervous?
Ich bin nicht, Sid?
No.
Ne réponds jamais quand on parle yiddish. Dis-moi que t'es juif. Je sais que t'es juif. Dis-moi la vérité. Dis-moi la vérité.
Arrêtez!
Je sais que t'es juif! Est-ce que t'es juif?
Non.
Si, t'es juif.
Non, je suis pas juif.
Si, t'es juif.
Non.
Je sais que t'es juif.
Non, je suis pas juif.
Pardon, chouchou. Pardon. Faut mieux prendre une claque qui fait mal que de perdre la vie parce qu'on a peur d'en prendre une.
All right, A Bag of Marbles is directed by Christian Duguay, and it stars Dorian LeClique, Batista Floreal, Patrick Bruhl, and a few others, but those are the main players of the film. I'm sure we'll focus a lot on those three characters specifically. If you're not familiar with A Bag of Marbles, it's about the adventures of a Jewish boy and his brother escaping Nazi persecution in occupied France during World War II. And Brendan, I'm not sure if I've ever seen a sentence written down on paper or in digital form otherwise. The words adventure and Jewish boy and escaping Nazi persecution in the same sentence together. I'm not sure who wrote that.
Well,
but, wow.
I feel like adventure kind of creates almost like a positive connotation with it, too. So maybe there is a bit of a misconception with the tone of that sentence.
Yeah, because it's not Indiana Jones adventure. Let's just put it that way. So
no.
This is World War II, after all. It is occupied France, so the adventures at the center of this film are anything but fun and lively. So let's go ahead and dive further into that, though, Brendan. What did you think about A Bag of Marbles?
We should also mention that this is based on an autobiography, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. by Joseph Joffo, I believe his name yeah. is, who is the main young boy here, played by Dorian Leclerc. And yeah. it's also directed, as you mentioned, by Christian Duguay. I hope we're pronouncing that name right. This is he's a director I'm not terribly familiar with. I know, looking at his filmography, he's done a lot of very cheap and badly reviewed action films before, such as mm-hmm. The Art of War with Wesley Snipes. And I mention that because I think that makes for a very interesting contrast between movies like that and A Bag of Marbles, which is a film that I think actually understands that simplicity is sometimes more frightening than knowing all of the details. Duguay, he avoids the politics and the historical accuracies of the Holocaust and instead visualizes this experience from the perspective of ignorance and youth, assuming that this horrid situation isn't always fully understood. And by retaining such a youthful focus, I feel like Duguay is able to put his attention on this story's notions of familial pride, but more specifically, Jewish pride, and its virtues of remaining true to your heritage, even when you know you will be judged for it. Throughout this entire movie, one of the most, I guess, almost symbolic representations of this are seeing people constantly battle whether or not they have to admit that they are in fact Jewish, not just for safety reasons, which is certainly apparent, but simply for being proud of who you are. And I think this is where the film is at its most effective, in those moments of tenderness shared among family members who pride themselves on who they are as Jews. And I do think the familial bond between these individuals is very much felt. I think the performances are very good, especially from the youngest, played by Dorian Leclerc, who does play Joe, as he's called here. And I think the film is even stronger when focusing on these two young brothers who are forced to fend for themselves, completely clueless as to what is going on around them. It's in the simplicity where I think the film works best. I do wish that the plot and the narrative here also understood that same sense of simplicity, and this is my biggest issue with the film. The pacing is incredibly rapid. A lot happens in this movie at under 2 hours long. There's a lot of characters, and I don't think we always get to know everything that's actually trying to be intertwined here. Certain people who are actually meant to be important to the story almost come off like an afterthought. It's maybe just one of these cases where perhaps too much story is trying to be handled here, and I don't think Duguay is able to handle it all with enough justification to balance it all out. In fact, this is pretty much why the final 10 minutes are simultaneously, for me, very thematically poignant and also emotionally frustrating. I think it is perhaps too busy of a film that sometimes feels narratively disjointed, and sometimes the constant saving and fleeing does become a little tedious at times. I still applaud this film for wanting to sustain a more closed off and familial approach to this historical subject. Mm-hmm. And when that focus is in light, I think the film is actually quite strong, and especially with mm-hmm. regard to the focus of those two brothers and the screen time that they share together. I recommend the film on those merits alone.
Well, I do want to start off my thoughts by reiterating that this film is getting pretty good reviews, and I was eager to see the film, not just because of that, and this is a foreign language film. We haven't talked about many this year, but as you're talking about, Brendan, at the center of this film, it's about a Jewish family in World War II, and in particular, it's about these two brothers who are trying to survive the chaos of everything that is happening around them. And you're right that they are very much ignorant to the outwardly circumstances that surround them, and seeing them react to that, it is really interesting to see. And I love that the film focuses heavily on that. It doesn't dwell in historical context like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. We actually don't get much of that. It's mostly about this family simply reacting to what is unfolding in front of them. And obviously, as we all know, because we are familiar as an audience with World War II and Jewish persecution from the Germans at that time. But to this family, there's a lot of uncertainty that comes with a lot of that, right? And so right. seeing this family
respond with that sense of urgency, with a level of ignorance and youth, especially from the teenager's point of view. I really appreciated what the film has to say with all of that. You're talking about the level of Jewish pride that this film focuses on thematically and within the characterization of these characters. And I really love that about this film, because that sense of pride, especially with the Joseph character, who is the main protagonist of the film, that sense of pride tethers him to not just his overall family, but especially his father, whom he really adores. And when you get to the end of the film, after overcoming all of these hardships and difficulties, you see how things play out with his family, and the film becomes not just about pride and how one identifies themselves with their heritage, but it becomes a love letter to his father. And I loved seeing how those two things, his sense of pride and the adoration he has for his father, how those two things are so intimately connected in this film. You know, early on, as you know, the stakes are starting to ramp up a little bit more, we get this moment. It's actually the scene used in the clip to set up this conversation, where the father is trying to get these two young boys to be aware of the danger that they are about to thrust upon them by sending them out into France to go on this quote-unquote adventure, right? They're trying to get from Paris to Nice. And it's a pretty unsettling moment to see this father physically prepare his young boy. But it's also done with a lot of heart. It's very poignant, as much as it is devastating. And the relationship of father and son in this film does carry itself through to the very end. And you get to the final scene of the film, and it lingers on this line from the Joseph character, where he says something to the effect of, "You were here, Papa, and you always will be." And that really struck a chord with me. I agree with you, Brendan, that the film isn't perfect. It certainly has its issues. I don't know if I was as distracted by the pacing of this film. I can understand where you're coming from with that, though, because the film does have a sense of urgency, and it does move quite rapidly. And I never found the pacing disjointed in all of that. I think where the pacing hurts the film, or the direction overall, where it stifles some of the emotional and thematic progression of this film, is that it focuses so heavily on dramatic tension. It gets so redundant. It gets a bit tedious, as you're talking about, where we constantly see these characters find themselves in some sort of danger, and then they're conveniently saved by some unknowing source that seemingly comes out of nowhere, right? And that, to me, was the biggest frustration of this film, is that there are tons of conveniences and where these characters find themselves and how they're able to get out of certain situations. And I don't know the story of Joseph Joffo, and maybe some of this or all of it could be accurate. I really don't know. In some ways, though, it's hard to believe, because it is a series of vignettes, essentially, as far as we're getting into danger and then we're saved by, you know, some unknowing Superman that comes out of nowhere to help these boys out. I will say, though, despite that tediousness and that narrative cycle that we do see, there is enough heart in this film regarding family, Jewish pride, and how those scenes come together in this film, that it transcended those flaws for me. So you get to that final moment, and young Joseph is talking about his father and how close he was to him, how, you know, "You were always here." I can't lie to you, Brendan, it pretty much destroyed me. Like, it killed me. And
it's pretty much designed for people like you at this point now.
But I do think the film earns it, for the most part, because of the heart that is poured into the sequences between father and son. And it is very endearing to see them interact. You can tell that this father loves his kids. You can tell that Joseph really loves his dad and his mom. There are several scenes where he's screaming, "Please don't leave me. Please don't leave me." And I think seeing this family when they are together, there's a lot of intimacy poured into those moments. And the performances, I think, do a great job of rendering this close-knit family who have this Jewish pride, and that despite some of these narrative issues that we're talking about, I still think that emotion comes through. At least it did for me, and I found that poignancy quite earned because of that. I just wish the film focused less on its dramatic tension. That, to me, is where it does suffocate some of that thematic and emotional progression. But overall, I still think it's earned for the most part.
Yeah, and I do agree with you on that sense of dramatic tension that does feel very manufactured, because you're right, a lot of these occurrences do resolve themselves by what is essentially sheer dumb luck. And I understand that this is a true story, and perhaps this is how it actually played out for Joseph and his brother Maurice in these moments, but there comes to a point when you're adapting this to a feature film that these series of vignettes do feel like you're just kind of going through the motions and kind of maintaining the exact same plot thread throughout each individual point. And you definitely can notice the redundancy there. And when I say I had some emotionally frustrating issues with the final 10 minutes, it's not that moment you're talking about. I think that's a great moment. I agree with you in the final seconds of the film. It's really more around, and I'll be vague for spoiler's sake, there is a moment where Joseph goes into this room, gets on top of a table, and yells, "I'm Jewish." Mm. I'll leave it at that. Okay. It's a very thematically appropriate and necessary scene where this young boy is finally able to admit and, you know, embrace his Jewish pride, but also for the benefit of someone else that is now being seen as the quote-unquote enemy.
Yeah.
The reason why I have some problems with it, though, despite me loving what it means thematically, is that it's also narratively driven by the fact that he's trying to find this girl that he's crushing on, and there's all these other things that are kind of trying to be balanced around it from a plot standpoint. I think the mechanics there are a bit messy, and that's where I felt like the film was at its most frustrating, getting around some of those points. But I do love the themes behind it. I think the relationship between father and son is very strong, as you're saying. I think Patrick Brühl's performance is also very good. And you know you have a very good father-son relationship when you can feel it, even in a film where the father and son actually don't spend that much time together on screen.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's sustained means that there is some great work there by the respective actors playing these parts.
I know. Outside of that first act, we only see the father interact with the boys maybe three other times outside of that. And they're pretty brief moments, but the film does such a great job, as I said in my opening thoughts, of pouring a lot of heart into those sequences, and the performances by everyone involved, I think, do a great job of, you know, demonstrating the bond that this family does have. And, and I do like that in Christian Duguay's direction as well. That, to me, is where the film succeeds. And it's very important given where this film goes. To that scene that you're talking about where young Joseph is standing on that table, I agree that perhaps getting to that moment is a bit uneven. The whole shtick with the girl and the crush, I don't know if I needed to have that.
I didn't.
What I do appreciate about it, though, is that it does render this sense of normalcy that these characters are trying to seek among, you know, this evil that is happening around them. And I liked the ideas on paper, and perhaps in a book it comes through more fleshed out. But in a film that surrounds itself with so much dramatic tension, that I didn't find it necessary. Like, it just didn't progress Joseph in a way that served this particular story. Although I do like the idea on paper and what it means for him as a young boy who is trying to grow up in these circumstances, it does make sense. It's just not fully realized in a way that is meaningful, I'll say. But once we get to him standing on that table, despite how messy some of the plot mechanics are, I still like the moment. I still still think Dorian Lickleck's performance and how he wraps himself in that familial pride, I did find that really interesting. And I think I find it interesting, maybe not so much because of the pride itself, but more so how it ties back to his father, because there are scenes in the first act where they're talking about their Jewish heritage, you know, and what it means to them and why they're having to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he gets cathartic there on that table, you can argue that it's not so much about the pride, although I'm sure he is proud to be Jewish, but it bonds him to his father, someone he hasn't seen in a long time. But that Jewish pride is what connects him to his family. And I love how the both of them there are interconnectively working together, that makes that moment really elegant, I think.
Yeah, and maybe that's why this father-son relationship is still felt and maintained throughout the film, despite the lack of physical time spent together on screen. It's because of that gradual growth in the young Joseph character. And I want to reiterate, Doran Licklick's performance is quite good because his gradual and very subtle growth, I do like that this character only very subtly progresses throughout the film. And if there's anything that Duguay does very well as a director, it's the focus on the characterization of this film. And I think that's his strongest point. But young Joseph here, the way he transitions throughout the film, it's very much parallel to what his father not only taught them, but his own ideologies of Jewish pride and what it actually means to maintain that for a safe family. There's a great scene about maybe midway through, which is also simultaneously, again, one of the more frustrating scenes for me, when the two boys get captured and they're interrogated by these officers. It's frustrating because it leads to some moments of manufactured tension that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, it's actually a very good scene because it's young Joseph who actually kind of snaps. You know, he actually makes an instant change here, and he's the one that has to defend themselves with more vigor and bravery, which was not only kind of surprising, but you can actually sense a parallel to what his father taught them, and you can actually see some very distinct personality traits that both of these characters shared that actually helps maintain that father-son relationship, even despite the fact that the father's not even on screen in this moment.
Yeah.
It's just the two young brothers, but you can get that. There's a level of nostalgia there that makes it work.
Yeah, there's a lot of ramifications in the Joseph character that come through because of what his father had taught him and the bond that is there, how much he loves his father. Yeah, there are several examples in this film that crystallize in a very specific way that is the result of that father-son relationship. And, you know, despite how, you know, manufactured some of the narrative is, there is so much heart poured into that in this film that I couldn't help be moved by it. I also think several of those moments, including that scene that you're talking about where Joseph snaps, I think there's weight to it because of the brother relationship in this film as well,
right?
Where Joseph's older brother Maurice, you know, they are having to survive on their own. And so much of this film, while it is about pride, it is about family, it's also in a lot of ways simply about perseverance, right? Where you see these two brothers out on this, you know, as they say, adventure of sorts. And at times when it's just the two brothers wandering around, it kind of, it does remind me of Lord of the Rings, where they're just out in the wilderness walking. We do get several shots like that in this film where...
So instead of a marble, it's a ring. So basically you got Frodo and Sam.
Basically, that's what we get. We get the Frodo and Sam elements of Lord of the Rings in this film with the brother dynamic. But, you know, and it is funny to see them interact. You know, there's a really funny moment, I thought, where, you know, Joseph had hurt his foot and Maurice is like, I'm going to carry you and you're my younger brother. I would carry you to the end of days. And they go about 10 feet. And then he's like, you're getting too heavy. You got to get off my back.
Yeah. Well, there's another great parallel to that moment too, later on, where the older brother starts limping in a very similar way. And the younger brother, who is now kind of really embrace that sense of perseverance that you're talking about and has really grown here, offers to carry Maurice, the older brother, and he just puts him down saying, no, you're not doing that. And it's actually kind of heartwarming, but also a bit humorous in the way that it's portrayed, and I do agree with you there.
Yeah, and I do like that humor. It does bring some levity into this film where, you know, the dramatic tension of the film obviously has a lot of stakes to it. And we all know where the film is going with those specific stakes, which is why I love that you get a lot of focus here on familial tension or sometimes just familial levity, where it's just two brothers interacting with each other on a normal basis. And that sense of normalcy we see at times in this film, I just found really charming. And I think it does speak to the perseverance we see and how these brothers overcome the adversity that they're having to face. And while it's convenient from a plot standpoint and how they get out of some of these situations, seeing them together in those specific moments, I think is great on a thematic and a characterization level. There's something about how that works in this film that just transcends the narrative obviousness of, you know, putting these characters in these very contrived, you know, circumstances to get them out. That I was actually never distracted by that. It was slightly frustrating, but there's something about seeing these brothers do it together and how the film depicts all of that, that I was equally as moved by.
Yeah, and I think we bring up these criticisms because it's the idea that this film actually could have been a lot more poignant and a lot stronger if there was more of a focus on just that duality between these two brothers. I would have much preferred to, you know, have no narrative convenience in getting from one plot point to the next and just have these two brothers kind of randomly show up at the next checkpoint, if you will, if more time was spent on just these two characters observing their surroundings rather than focusing on the escape from them. And I think if there was maybe a bit more of a focus on that sense of characterization, which, as I said, Duguay has a great sense of characterization here. That's the strongest point of the film, and I wish that there was even more focus put on that. I think the film definitely could have been a lot stronger.
Yeah, and I also wish that some of this dramatic tension came more sparingly. I agree with you that the progression of these characters is fleshed out extremely well, given the fact that there is a lot of, you know, manufactured storytelling in this film when it comes to that tension. I did become emotionally involved with these characters despite that, but I do wish that some of that dramatic tension, you know, was sparingly used, because there are some sequences that I really liked. For example, the first moment they encounter on the train and how this stranger helps them out, I actually thought was a really great moment. It was the
first
time.
Well, that was more natural.
Yeah, that felt very natural. But then it started to happen all the time. And that, to me, took me out of the film slightly. You know, as I said, watching those two characters interact as brothers kept me invested in where things were going to go. But the more natural moments, I actually really liked. You know, there's also a moment where they're captured, as you're talking about, and they interact with this doctor that I found compelling as well on a dramatic level and especially a thematic level. So there are a few times it works, and if the film just pulled a few of those to keep the dramatic tension there without overbearing us with it.
Yeah.
I agree with you. At the end of this film, oh, I can't even imagine. It would have been close to a midnight special ending for me.
I can't blame you on that. Perhaps more simplicity would have just done the film a little bit more good, because that sense of simplicity, as I said, is where the film is at its strongest.
All right, let's get to final thoughts. We'll go back to you, Brennan. Any final thoughts you have on A Bag of Marbles?
Well, one word that you used a bit earlier in this discussion, JD, that I think maybe would have also helped in creating more organic tension in this film is the word uncertainty. And you used that pretty early on, because there is a lot of uncertainty when it comes to the situation that these two brothers are in. And I think that's actually where the film is at its most tense, where it doesn't also feel manufactured. There's a sense of mystery that sometimes finds itself front and center, not knowing where your parents are, not knowing what will happen if your Jewish heritage is found out, not knowing who to trust, and more importantly, not knowing what will happen if you maintain that sense of religious pride that you so thrive on. And there are a lot of questions that come with that. I think that's where the film is at its most intense, and I think that that would have been a stronger point to even focus more on that. And what I love about that, too, in, you know, especially with regard to what I said about Jewish pride, is that Duguay doesn't dwell too specifically in Jewish heritage itself. That just comes with the territory, given the fact that this is a Holocaust film.
Sure.
But it's a bit more open-minded than that. You can find a relatability just in religious pride itself, regardless of what your own beliefs are. So I think there's an ability for an audience member to imbue his or her own religious beliefs into the context of this story and find something to grasp onto. I think that's where it's at its strongest, and I do wish that some of the narrative here and some of the manufactured tension that we're saying could have been a bit more closed off. And I think that just would have helped some of these ideas really come more into fruition, if that makes any sense. So I think there are great ideas there. I think there are some great performances. I think there's a great subtlety in the progression of these characters, especially literally and even physically. The way that these two brothers age throughout this small amount of time that goes by, it actually looks pretty natural. And it was also very subtle, too. It almost looked like the film did take its time for a couple of years to film this experience, to actually see these kids grow up in the process of this situation. And I actually thought that was a really nice touch by Duguay from a direction standpoint. Certainly far from perfect. I think it is narratively messy at times. But aside from that, I think there is poignancy in its themes and in its familial notions on Jewish pride. So with that, I give this a recommendation for those merits alone.
Yeah, I do think when it comes to the family dynamics at the center of this film, the Jewish pride, how that bonds these young brothers with their father, I found all of that really lucid and authentic and quite potent in how it all crystallizes at the end, as we've been talking about. And I also want to emphasize that while this is a Holocaust movie, it obviously has lots of dramatic tension, as we've been talking about and mostly criticizing, and how the film employs that dramatic urgency. It's interesting that this is a Holocaust film that doesn't relish in the dour nature of what's happening around these two boys. You're right that there is a sense of uncertainty, as we said earlier, and that these two young boys, they're just ignorant of the realities of what's around them. Just the raw devastation of what happened in World War II, they don't really know that. Some of the adults don't even really know that. And I love how the film narrowly focuses in on that. And I think that's where that sense of pride and this simple yearning to reconnect with your family and how they have to persevere and overcome adversity in order to do that, I think that thrives in this film because of how the film kind of simplifies things instead of having a broader focus on the Holocaust and World War II. You know, as much as I love something like Schindler's List, and that is one of my favorite Spielberg films, but that does dive a little bit more heavily and more broadly into, you know, what happened with the Jewish people in those
internment camps. It's about the horrors of this situation.
Absolutely.
It's a very different movie.
It is. And I love that this film, in a lot of ways, is the antithesis to that. It doesn't have that same dour nature. It's actually quite upbeat. It has funny moments, as we were talking about earlier with the brothers. And you just don't see that often with Holocaust movies. And it's very understandable, right? Because it was really horrific what happened to the Jewish people at that time. So for film to dive into those horrors, it is understandable. And I love how this film kind of flips that coin on its head a little bit and focuses more on the normal day-to-day of how characters can interact with one another in between the moments of horror, if you will.
Yeah.
So,
and if I may jump in on that quickly, because you're talking about a film like this that approaches the Holocaust and that subject matter in a very different way. The film that this actually reminded me a little bit of was Roberto Benigni's Life is Beautiful. And even though, despite the criticisms that I'm bringing up here with A Bag of Marbles, I actually like this film better than Life is Beautiful, which I don't think actually had a very good handle on its tonal inconsistencies, I guess you can say. I actually think this film manages a little bit better, but they both do something rather similar in trying to find almost an innocent and ignorant and lighthearted approach to this subject. And in some ways, by doing so, at least here, it actually adds a more devastating quality because of how it's being perceived and that unknowingness that comes with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially on an emotional level with this young boy who's, what, 10 years old, maybe.
Yeah.
So he's quite young, and emotionally speaking, I think relishing more in that uncertainty, I think, is tonally and dramatically very appropriate for this film.
Yeah.
And I think the results at the very end of the film come to fruition in great ways, as we've been talking about, because of mm-hmm. that. And while it doesn't have the same kind of dour nature as other Holocaust films, as we've been talking about, this film still has a lot of heart. It is very poignant in a lot of yeah. places. And I do want to emphasize a few scenes that really stood out to me. Again, going back to that clip we used to set up this conversation, when the father starts slapping the young boy and how he reacts to that. Dorian LeClerc's performance there is really stunning, I think.
It's great.
And really engaging you with his character. That very much moved me. And even prior to that, just seeing this family in their happy place with that pillow fight, I thought was really endearing in setting up
yeah.
the bond of this family. There's a moment where they reconnect at this beach and they're all interacting, which I thought was maybe a bit schmaltzy, but still very endearing nonetheless.
Sure.
And I love that. And as we were saying earlier, there's a few more scenes where the father interacts with these young boys. There's a phone call between the two brothers and their mom at one point in the film. And that sense of family comes together in a great way that, as I said, mm-hmm. moved me quite heavily in those final moments. And I think yeah. that tonal balance of dramatic tension and heart and emotion and even the little bits of humor we get, I found all of that actually quite seamless. The only mm-hmm. major criticism I have of this film are the conveniences. And again,
yeah,
I don't know Jaffo's story. Maybe those things happened. It's kind of hard to believe, though, at yeah. the same time. So I think perhaps a lot of this was, you know, contrived for dramatic sake.
Perhaps.
And that's perfectly fine. I don't really know, but it's hard not to notice those conveniences and how we arrive at those conveniences.
Yeah.
That said, everything else I recommend. I very much recommend this film. Please go and seek it out if you can. I know it's only playing in, you know, limited art house theaters here and there, but mm-hmm. if you can check it out now or when it comes out on Blu-ray and VOD, please do yourself a favor and check it out. It's not your typical Holocaust movie. I do think you'll get something from it that's new. So with that said, I will have more thoughts on Letterboxd if you want to continue the conversation there at letterboxd.com/InSessionFilm.
And if you agree or disagree with what we just had to say about A Bag of Marbles, let us know by leaving a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/InSessionFilm. You could tweet us at InSessionFilm, leave us a comment on our Google Plus page, or email us directly at InSessionFilm@gmail.com.
All right, stay tuned. We are going to take a quick break here. And on the other side, we are going to be joined by the Vern from Cinema Recall. I will step away to play with my bag of six balloons as Brendan and
Vern. You gotta stop making that illusion.
Look, I got my balloons here, and I'm going to play balloon volleyball or something to that effect while you guys talk about
six. I'm guessing Sam
balloons.
Is with you right now, because otherwise I can't imagine you doing that by yourself.
Yeah, we'll say Sam is here. We'll go with that.
All right, fair enough.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. On the other side, they'll talk about six balloons. So stay with us. We'll be right back. A perfect liar said you'd save me. Love, love. I know the moment I looked into your eyes, I'd have to swallow all your lies.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everybody. My name is Davern, and I am the host of the Cinema Recall Podcast, which you can find at thatmomentin.com. On each episode, myself, along with a great guest, we will discuss in detail an iconic scene from a classic movie. So come check us out. We are available on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and most other places you can find podcasts. We are also on Facebook. Just type in Cinema Recall. And we are also on Twitter at @cinema_recall. We hope you enjoy the show, and thank you for listening.
Hello, In Session Film Podcast listeners. We take a moment to interrupt this daily programming to bring you the Next Best Picture Podcast, run by myself, Matt Neglia, where Michael Schwartz, Will Matheny, Dan Chiesese, Ryan C. Showers, and a slew of others, we are all on a search to find what is going to be the next Best Picture winner at the Oscars. Join us on our journey as we look at foreign films, documentaries, independent movies, as well as big action blockbusters. Everyone is a contender until they are not. Be sure to listen to us on all of the podcasting networks, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Player FM, and on CastBox. Be sure to come check us out on nextbestpicture.com, where we also have movie reviews, weekly polls, the before-mentioned podcast, as well as a lot more content revolving around the award season. Thank you so much for listening to me ramble. Now, back to JD and Brandon.
You're listening to the In Session Film Podcast Extra Film segment, Suck It Up, Walk It Off, Grow a Pair.
Dad always says the exact same thing.
What?
You know, think about it.
All right, yeah.
Suck it up, walk it off, grow a pair. And then let them dangle.
I don't remember that part. I think that's a new addition.
Maybe. No, Dad doesn't really joke with me anymore. It's weird.
In 1.3 miles, turn left onto North Aguro Street. Then merge onto CA 110 north towards Pasadena.
I know what Mom will say, too.
What?
She'll tell me I broke her heart. She really loves to tell me that.
All right, before we continue on with this week's Extra Film segment, we are once again joined by a great guest this week, and I'd like to take the time to introduce The Vern from The Vern's Video Vortex, as well as podcasts such as The Cinema Recall and The Film Pasture. Vern, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Brendan. I'm not doing The Film Pasture anymore. I'm mainly just concentrating.
Oh, man.
Yeah, sorry. It got to be too much, man, and my workload for The Cinema Recall has gotten to be way too much. It's hard for me to do that many podcasts, do a blog, work a full-time job. So yeah, I had to cut one of those off. So it's mainly just The Cinema Recall right now, bud.
When did that happen? And because this is actually news to me.
Well, actually, I started doing The Film Pasture a while, and then David Dupre, the owner of thatmomentin.com, he got in contact with me to do a podcast for his site. And since this site is all about great moments in movies, I wanted to do a podcast that represents that. So the podcast is called Cinema Recall, and it's where me and a guest will discuss iconic moments in movies and break them down and discuss why they are so iconic.
That is really great, and I urge everyone listening to check out Cinema Recall. I really think it's a great conversation that you and various guests have on that respective show. I was actually a little bit unaware of the Film Pasture no longer existing on your side of things, so I have to apologize on that side. But
needless to say,
you're still maintaining some great work that I have to urge our listeners to go and check out. And I have to say, Vern, it's great to have you back on again, because if I remember correctly, the last time you were on was actually another Extra Film episode last year, where you and Vince Leo discussed Ingrid Goes West.
Yes.
That was some time ago.
Come on, it's got my crushes on there. Elizabeth Olsen, Aubrey Plaza. Can't go wrong with that.
Absolutely not. Yeah. So you guys had a great discussion there. Hopefully we can maintain that same type of conversation with this week's main review. And since it has been a while, Vern, you know, this should be seen as a celebratory experience, and usually celebrations come with balloons. It's too bad that the film we are about to talk about, despite having balloons in the title, deals in subject matter that isn't meant to be celebrated. And that brings us to our main review this week, and we'll be talking about another Netflix original film. It is called Six Balloons.
You mean,
and
this,
it is written,
this not the prequel to It?
It's not. I thought that same thing myself,
More
but
balloons?
Unfortunately, we're not quite there with It Chapter 2. We still got quite a while, and this is not that film.
Okay.
Instead, it is a very, very different film. If you're not familiar with Six Balloons, it is written and directed by Marja Lewis Ryan and stars Abby Jacobson and Dave Franco, as well as a few others that we will probably get into. And it tells the story of a young woman, played by Jacobson, who learns that her brother, Dave Franco, has relapsed on heroin. Very simple as that. There's a little bit more to it, but this is a rather simple story. And similar to our discussion of Kodachrome last week, as I mentioned, Six Balloons is yet another Netflix original film. And that fact alone may already come with some positive or negative preconceived notions, depending on your viewpoint of Netflix and their overall distribution strategy. But they have released plenty of high-quality films before, so Vern, I'll toss it to you first. How does Six Balloons stack up with Netflix's overall filmography?
You know, it's kind of amazing that Netflix picked this movie to be on their streaming service, because most of the films that have been on their service have been kind of like fun popcorn-style flicks, no matter if they're good or bad. You got like Bright on there, and then like I believe like 2 Weeks was the most recent one with Adam Sandler and Chris Rock. And I recently just watched Annan, and Annan had the nice type of concept that it could have been shown at a wider release. I mean, it had a well-known named director with Andrew Davis, the same guy who did Gattaca and wrote The Truman Show. But here's a feature from a first-time director, and the only real star of the movie is Dave Franco.
Right.
And this is a movie that if it wasn't for Netflix, this would have been a made-for-TV drama. This is something I would see on the Lifetime channel or Hallmark, all right? Because it does discuss drug addiction, but it's not as heavy-handed as movies like Requiem for a Dream or Trainspotting or even Heaven Knows What. From the Safdie brothers that came out a few years ago. I mean, those are really heavy movies about drug addiction. And Six Balloons, for me, just felt like it was missing something a little bit there. Because you got the story of, remember now, Katie, played by A.B. Jacobson, and she's getting prepared for a birthday party for her boyfriend, a surprise birthday party. And then she gets word that Dave Franco's character, Seth, is basically at his place, and he hasn't shown up there. And this part that was confusing me, was she trying to bring him to this party? I mean, did her mom want her to bring him?
And I'm not sure if it's ever made clear.
Yeah, so, but she has to go there and pick him up, and he has this six-year-old daughter, beautiful girl, and he's just like tweeting out, and she tries to bring him to rehab, but they don't have the right insurance card, and he asks her to help pay for his sessions, and I don't really know. Here's the weird thing, too. They go to the one place, they tell her to go to this other place that does accept her insurance, and on the way there, she decides to help him get high. And I know, I apologize if I go into spoilers in this, and if I do, please stop me.
Yeah, we always try not to, so be as vague as you can if you don't mind.
Okay, I'll try my best to be vague on this one here too, but
yeah.
She made some choices in the matter, and it's the choices that she made me really dislike the character, and just, I didn't really feel anything for this person. I mean, what was the point? Yeah, so the whole movie for me was kind of a letdown, just because we've seen movies with this type of subject matter before. this is a movie that is about a woman who is in love with her brother, wants to write for him, but at the start of the movie, she has one opinion towards him. You know, she feels one way, and it's the way that her opinion changes for me really just kind of lost me, because it really just made no sense of why, in the middle of it, she would suddenly change her mind, if I'm making sense there.
No, you definitely are, and I do want to bring that up because there is a moment in the back half of this film that I do think is kind of the film's defining moment that people are going to be talking about. I do want to arrive to that, and you know, I want to remain as vague as possible for spoiler's sake. Yeah. But you're right in that this is a rather simple film, especially when compared to other movies about addiction. In fact, not including the end credits here, I think Six Balloons actually runs under 70 minutes long.
Yes.
It's a very, very brief film. I will say, I actually kind of like the simplicity here, especially how this entire film takes place over the course of only a couple of hours. The way that the film moves almost feels like it's almost in real time, which I think, along with the performances, I actually think Dave Franco especially is quite good here. I think it adds a level of intensity and dramatic tension that does make the experience feel pretty authentic at times. And as I mentioned, this then arrives to a single moment of decisiveness where one character makes a particular unethical choice, we'll say, that raises a lot of morally ambiguous questions. And I do think that Marja Lewis Ryan, the writer and director here, is deliberately asking us to take part in that debate. So I guess on my side of this, Vern, I didn't really see it as a means of someone's opinion of someone else changing. I see it as a pretty fascinating debate that's actually coming around here. And I think it's more so about someone that just wants to have a sense of normalcy with a family member and going through a certain mean to actually do that.
Okay, no, that's a very interesting point, and I wish I would have saw in the movie something that happened earlier. Maybe it's a scene of them at childhood or something like that that would make me feel that sibling connection, because I didn't actually quite feel that when I was watching it, because in the very beginning of the movie, Katie, she is very kind of annoyed by Seth because she's trying to put this party together. She's got her friends there, and now she has to deal with her brother and the problem that he's going with right now. And it made matters worse. He has a little girl on top of that, and I know she wants to bring normalcy into her life, but just the choice that she made didn't seem to make much sense. Mainly because that she's there hosting a party and she gets a call for her brother's in trouble. Here's the thing, too. She's close. When she's in the car with him, she could have easily just gone back to the party with him, and the choices that she made, it was just hard for me to buy into it. I'm sorry, man.
Well, no, it's perfectly fine. I do think that frustration is kind of deliberate, because I do think that there is a lot of frustration out of love for her, and also at the same time trying to balance her own selfish pride, I guess you could say, and her own, you know, her own status and her own popularity amongst her friends and her boyfriend and her status with her parents as well. I sort of do get that, and maybe it's because I'm still of the youthful and younger mindset that I guess I can relate to some of those notions a bit too, but I do think the performances are able to elevate past some of that, which is why I was able to feel and sense the sibling relationship enough that I was dramatically engaged with it enough. But I will say there are distractions that probably could have made it a bit better. And this goes into my biggest criticism with the movie, despite that daring scriptwriting choice that Marja Lewis Ryan makes about two-thirds of the way through. Because there is some good moral ambiguity to that choice that she makes in the script. I don't think her direction is able to match all that same moral ambiguity. And I do think that Ryan relies way too heavily on symbolic obviousness. There are many moments of like this visualization of drowning. There's this use of this self-help voiceover narration that kind of comes and goes almost rapidly throughout the film. And she repeats these same cues way too often throughout this 70-minute runtime. And I do think she also attempts to manufacture physical tension that I don't really think was all that necessary. I think the performances and that thematic ambiguity is enough to provide that tension that the film actually needs. I don't think we needed to utilize a very frenetic editing style, loud bursts of music to try to achieve that. And maybe those moments are what is a bit distracting and actually enhancing that sibling relationship that you needed more of.
Okay. Well, and it's a good thing, Brandon, that you brought up that self-help book, because when the movie begins and she's listening to the self-help book, I'm thinking, okay, mm-hmm. well, that's kind of an interesting way to begin a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout the whole thing, I get what's supposed to represent as a metaphor for her life. And the book is, she's on this dock, and then there's this boat, and each chapter, she's like on a boat, and you're driving a boat, mm-hmm. and oh my gosh, you're drowning. Okay, I get it. You're representing your problems you're having with your brother. Okay, I get it. All right. Things are getting worse in the story, then you gotta talk about that chapter in the book. And it's just mm-hmm. very, very in your face.
It is.
Metaphors right there. And I just really could not get myself into that. I'm like, no, screw it. I don't want to see the story anymore about the heroin addiction. Just talk about the girl on the boat. All right? Let's just do that. All right? Let's have this whole thing mm-hmm. to be about a girl on a boat and she can't drive the freaking boat and, oh no, the boat's going to sink. Okay, yeah, I get it. Her life is kind of sinking downhill. The boat's sinking too. All right? I get it. All right? And then near the end too, they literally give you a lot of visual metaphors. At first it was just like audio metaphors, but now in the mm-hmm. end they give you a lot of like visual metaphors too. I believe what you said too, Brandon. The performances of this performance are good, especially when you have two actors who are mainly known for being in comedies.
Sure.
I believe that Abby Jackson is known for being a cast member in the series Broad City. And she's done a lot of work for like College Humor. Most stuff I've seen on her IMDb board is mostly comedies. Same thing with Dave Franco. I think the only thing that I've known Dave Franco to be in dramatically in was the Disaster Artist. Mm-hmm. But most of his stuff has always been comedy roles and doing the slapstick comedy. So when he does make the change to dramas, Dave Franco can do an actual good job. I'm not at all dissing on their performances. It's mainly about the story and the script writing that Marja Lewis Ryan put into her characters. I think she if she wanted to display that this Katie character is kind of torn, you know, with her new boyfriend, because she seems to have like a good life, she got a good boyfriend, everything like that there.
Right.
And her brother, I wanted to see more of that sibling love there, because at the start of the movie, she's angry at this guy. She calls him a loser for not staying in rehab and everything. And then she makes this choice, and it was just right then and there. I'm like, you know what? I'm sorry. This is going to sound cruel, but you kind of deserve all bad things that happen to you.
I don't know if I agree with that. And I will say there are choices that she makes. There's that one choice we keep bringing up that happens two-thirds of the way through the film that is, as I said, it's very unethical. It's arguably the wrong choice. I think it does come with some pity on my side, though, because, as I said, it's really driven by the fact that she just wanted her brother back. And when Dave Franco's character, Seth, makes this very interesting physical change in this moment, and you could see a very happy individual, you could see someone that actually is, in the eyes of his own daughter, being a good father yet again, even despite the ways that that is brought out, it raises a lot of questions and it raises a lot of red flags. And I do think that is the point, which is why I don't really have much of a problem with the script writing here. It's really more so in Ryan's direction and the fact that he chooses to suffocate this film with manufactured tension and forced symbolism that I think could have maybe enhanced some of those problems that you had. I appreciate her passion in this story and trying to imbue it with that sense of passion in the visual, but perhaps it does become a bit suffocating. But like I said, I do think the performances are able to elevate some of that, which is why I could sense that dramatic urgency that I do feel like the movie was mostly trying to get at. With all of that said, though, I want to toss it back to you, though, for any final thoughts as we round out this conversation. Overall, though, any other final thoughts you have, and what do you overall think of Six Balloons?
Okay. Six Balloons has got really good performances. I'm glad it's short, but if you're doing a movie about drug addiction, especially from the perspective of another sibling character who's witnessing their own brother have a demise of this, I guess if this is the first time she experienced these problems with Seth, then maybe mm-hmm. I could understand her problems a little bit more because she just wanted her brother back. But this is stuff right. that happened before. I mean, he's been in and out of rehab before. So when she does make her choices there, I just have a feeling that you know what's going to happen. And that I just mm-hmm. couldn't bring myself into feeling like she did in her shoes there. But like I said, okay. the performances were really good, especially from actors who are known for being mainly comedians. I am very curious about Marja Lewis Ryan's upcoming movies here. Apparently, she's doing a. I don't know if it's a remake of Splash or a new movie called Splash, but she's one of the writers of Splash.
Okay.
Coming out here.
I didn't know that.
Coming out there soon. So yeah, this being the fact this is kind of her first debut feature. She does have a lot of good visuals right there. She knows how to tell, I shouldn't say, a story in a short amount of time. And like you said before, too, it's kind of cool that it was all done in kind of like just one night, which is mm-hmm. really cool. So she knows how to direct well. I just really wish she worked on her characters a little bit more. But that's okay. that's just me. That's my own personal nitpick about the movie there. But yeah, I mean, it's a short watch right there. I didn't hate my time watching this. And it's a good kind of discussion piece. And maybe people can actually have conversations about what to do with people who are addicted to drugs. And yeah. it kind of makes a weird conversation, kind of like what we're doing right now.
Yeah, and I think that's very much the point of the film. And I do think because of that, those are the merits alone why I would still recommend this film. Because I do think it does spark some pretty good conversation like the one that we're having, and also around the moral ethics and the ramifications of those choices that happen two-thirds of the way through. And I do want to talk about that scene a little bit, which does take place in a drugstore, and it's simultaneously one of the more frustrating scenes in the movie for me, but also one of the better scenes in the movie too. It does rely perhaps a little closely to narrative convenience in order to get where it does. I don't know anything about how the pharmacy market works, but the way that this situation comes into fruition, I should say, made me scratch my head a little bit. I'll simply say that.
Yeah.
But there are some pretty interesting uses of tone here that I do really like. And in fact, the moment actually crystallizes with some pretty good humor. And you see two young siblings, well, not really young anymore, but they start to act irresponsible together as if that they are becoming reacquainted with their own childhood that they remember each other for. And I think that's where these two actors, who, as you said, Vern, are mostly comedians, that's where some of their comedic chops actually come back into play. And I do think it actually adds some poignancy to the film. So it simultaneously has some issues narratively, but I do like where it goes emotionally. I do think the performances are able to bring it up together in that way.
So let me ask you this, Brendan. Why do you think the movie was called Six Balloons? Because I thought it would have been called Fireworks. Because
especially where it goes, I'm still thinking about that myself. There is a moment where the young daughter is carrying what appears to be a couple of balloons toward the film's climax, and I couldn't count them because I just didn't. So maybe there is a literal metaphor to it that I just didn't really quite get, but I do think that there is meant to be some connection to their own respective childhoods as to where the title actually comes into play. And then there are some narrative comparisons to the fact that she is throwing this actual birthday party for someone else. So I do think that's where the connection comes into play, but I'm perhaps still ignorant to what it all actually means.
Gotcha.
I was too busy being distracted by, you know, that symbolism of drowning.
Yes.
And the metaphor of the boat and everything like that, which does have an obviousness to it, as we've been saying. And I do think more subtlety would have done this film a lot of good. In fact, I think this could have been somewhat of a special film if it did tone some of those things back, because I think there are great ideas here. But there are enough ideas that I do still recommend it.
Yeah.
And on those merits alone, I think it is a pretty fine watch. With all of that said, though, JD, who's not here for this discussion, has actually also seen Six Balloons. He actually offered up his thoughts on another podcast, Netflix and Swill, but he'll also throw up a few thoughts on Letterboxd that you can check out at letterboxd.com/insessionfilm, and he'll be sure to throw up a few more thoughts on our main show this weekend and continue some of the conversation there. But for those of you listening, if you have taken the time to watch Six Balloons and you agree or disagree with what Vern and I just had to say, let us know by leaving a comment on our Facebook page. You can also leave us a comment on our Twitter page or just email us directly at incessionfilm@gmail.com. Before we get out of here, though, I want to say once again, Vern, thanks again for being here, man. Really do appreciate it.
Dude, thank you so much, Brendan. I greatly appreciate it. Love the Incession Film. You and JD have all... You two are like basically the new Sicily Nieberts of the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Right there.
Wow. Do not make the chip on our shoulders get any bigger,
mean, you,
man.
You,
because
are, you guys are just amazing hosts.
Those are really kind words, man. I really do appreciate that. While you're here, though, I didn't get you to do this as much up front, but why don't you once again tell us a little bit about yourself, where we can find you online, a little bit about the Video Vortex, as well as Cinema Recall, and just kind of pimp out your stuff.
Oh, thank you, sir. All right. Well, Cinema Recall, that show is found at thatmomentin.com. We are part of a podcast network that has Game Warp, TV Good, Sleep Bad, and Asian Cinema Film Club, along with the Cinema Recall. You can follow us on Twitter. We are @cinema_recall. We are on most places you can find podcasts, such as Stitcher, Podomatic, Spotify, iTunes. Most of the places you can find podcasts. Just look for That Moment In, and you can find our show along with everybody else. I still rate at the Vern's Video Vortex, which is videovortex.wordpress.com. Mm-hmm. I think I just posted my review of A Quiet Place on there.
That's a controversial one from you.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We're not discussing that, all right? But
yeah, all right.
And then also on the site, That Moment In, I recently just did on Cinema Recall. Me and Audrey Fotz have rated M for McPhail. We did our episode about Saoirse Ronan and the movie Brooklyn, talking about our favorite moments from that. So check that out.
Nice. Yeah, absolutely. Check out all the work that the Vern here has been doing. Really great stuff and a great listen over at Cinema Recall. Really do appreciate you being here, Vern.
Thank you.
Can't wait to get you back on once again. Great to have you once again.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Vern, for being here. Really appreciate it. Sorry I didn't get a chance to interact with you this time. Hopefully next time I can be in on the conversation. Mm-hmm. As Brendan alluded to, though, and as I mentioned, I have seen Six Balloons. I've even discussed it on another show, but I'll still give a few brief thoughts this weekend on episode 273 in case you haven't listened to that Netflix and Swell episode. But long story short, Brendan and I are in pretty similar camps. So I'll give a few thoughts this weekend, though, in episode 273. With that said, though, Brendan, we can go ahead and transition here to the end of this week's extra film. Just a friendly reminder that you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're on Letterboxd, as we've said a few times here, letterboxd.com/incessionfilm. And you can always email us. That's a great way to get a hold of us as well. And that email is incessionfilm@gmail.com.
You can also subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. While you're there on iTunes, please leave us a review there. We really appreciate some feedback over there as well. You can also find us on Spotify. Simply search for In Session Film in your Spotify search bar, and you'll find us there for your easy listening pleasure. Or you can find us syndicated every single week at geekcastradio.com, the Podfix Network, and the Lamb Podcast Network. Or you could just go ahead and check out our Listen Now page straight from our website at incessionfilm.com/listen-now.
And the In Session Film podcast is supported by our great listeners like you. If you want to help us, just go to incessionfilm.com. There we have bonus content available. We have the In Session Film store. We got great sponsors you can check out. We have Patreon. We have a bunch of information at incessionfilm.com/donate. I suggest that you go to that link to see all of the information and how you can help us. I would also recommend our mobile app, where you can hear everything we do under one roof for just a one-time fee of $1.99. And you can find that app on the Amazon market for Android devices, the Windows 10 phone store for Windows devices, and the podcast source app for iOS devices. And all of those details are on the site at incessionfilm.com/apps. As for the main show this weekend on episode 273, as we talked about in the intro, we are going to be reviewing Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and I am very eager to jump into that conversation. For our top three, though, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Instead of tying it into our main review, we are instead going to be doing something mom-related, as it's Mother's Day this weekend. And Brendan, on the show, we have talked about our favorite movie dads not once, but twice.
Yeah.
And we haven't talked about movie moms at all. So wow. We need to...
We really need to amend that.
Yeah.
Man, we're going to get a lot of hatred from the Me Too movement for that.
Probably and very deservedly so. We do need to remedy that, and we will this weekend as we talk about our top three movie moms. And I guess to make it even a year down the road, maybe we'll do it again. So
yeah, just to make up for it.
Exactly. So I do look forward to diving into all of that, though, Brendan. Let's get to final thoughts. What do you got?
Well, I have to say, JD, not only am I really excited to talk about Vertigo on this weekend's main show, I think we need to get more in the habit of looking out for some of these big classic movies and their respective anniversaries that they celebrate. Mm-hmm. We did this last year with Close Encounters of the Third Kind celebrating its 40th anniversary. However, didn't 2001 A Space Odyssey celebrate its 50th anniversary a few months ago, and we didn't talk about that one? So... Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we need to... I'm not saying we need to go back and review that one. I'm just saying maybe we need to be a bit more on top of some of these things, because reviewing Vertigo and then skipping out on 2001, that almost seems to be a bit unforgivable on our side of things.
Yeah, I think so. It also depends on the week, because, you know, sometimes you get these anniversaries on... You know, the weekend Avengers Infinity War is coming out, and obviously we're not going to skip, you know, certain films like that. But I agree. I think in a general sense, we could do better at preparing ahead of time.
Well, this is what I'm here for, JD, is to criticize our own show while live.
You know, sometimes we just need to have these on-air production meetings and, you know, figure out what's wrong from time to time or how we could be better, so...
Yeah, don't those make for the best meetings, though, when we actually invite the listeners in, unwelcome, too? Like we're not even asking them to come in. We're forcing them to come in and listen to our own criticisms and the problems of our own show.
Well, it's a great idea, because hopefully some of these listeners can take note and... can help us stay on top of that. So, you know, if next month there's a major classic or film that needs to be talked about that's having an anniversary that we're unaware of, you know, they can let us know, and maybe we can plan ahead for that. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, because as we talked about on the show this last week, the summer going to have a few dead spots, you know, from time to time. So we'll probably have the opportunity to review some other films that aren't new and in the mainstream, I'll say. So,
yeah, gosh, that's such a depressing thought. The fact that this summer has a lot of blanks.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. But who knows if we can make it up by talking about Vertigo. And while we may have missed the opportunity, who cares? Let's talk about 2001, A Space Odyssey, a few...
Hey, it's still 2018, so it's still in its 50th year.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I guess we're only a few months late to the party.
Yeah, and we did talk about it on a top three not that long ago. So, I mean, at least we got a mention of it recently.
We know it exists.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, at some point during the summer, I think we could absolutely do that film as a featured review on the main show. Even if it is late, I think that's okay.
All right.
As far as a quick final thought for me, prior to this recording, and part of the reason, among many other things, I couldn't do any sort of preparation for Six Balloons, I went to a critics screening of Deadpool earlier, and I'm not going to give away any thoughts right now outside of what I threw up on Twitter earlier, if you follow us there. But I'll just quickly say that the mid-credit scene of Deadpool 2 could be the best end credits, mid-credit scene of any film I've ever seen that's been doing that sort of thing. It's pretty great.
You know, JD, I haven't seen the film yet, and when you open up with something very hyperbolic like that, now the expectations cannot be met.
Yeah, that's probably true. And, of course, humor is going to be subjective, especially the meta humor of Deadpool. But if you're into that kind of humor like I am, the commentary being made in the mid-credit scene is... on point. It is very, very good. So I'll just leave it at that. We'll talk about it more on episode 274 in about a week and a half from now. So,
all right.
With all of that said, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time on the In Session Film Podcast.
This was a podcast from the Podfix Network. You can check out more shows like it at podfixnetwork.com.